It's WFMU, that's Hooper Crescent with Staring at the Post. They're a Melbourne, Australia-based band. That record, Essential Tremors, came out sometime this past winter, and spent a lot of time listening to this album this past few months. I really enjoyed it, got a kick out of it, had fun listening to it. Echo and the Bunnymen before that with Turquoise Days, a live version from one of the John Peel sessions. We had R.I.P. Swirl before that, featuring Winter, a band named Winter. The song's called Perfectly Blue. We heard Hatchie before that. Pale Saints was in that set with Kinky Love. We heard The Sundays too with Here's Where the Story Ends. Oh my god, I've been really loving that song lately. We also heard Chappelle Roan in that set, Sophie, Muscle Cars, Fire Tools, bunch of stuff. You can see it online, WFMU.org. Hit playlist and comments and see what we heard today. The archive will be posted after the show as well on WFMU's website. Thanks everybody who came out last night to see the Pauline Oliveros documentary with me. We had a Q&A with the director, Daniel Weintraub, and it was a really, really nice night and really special for everyone who was there. In 2 weeks, on July 28th at 7 p.m., that's a Sunday, we are doing another documentary screening here at WFMU about Simond. They're a band. If you don't know Simond, like off the top of your head, like I can guarantee you've listened to them. They sampled a lot. Fugees, De La Soul, Wu-Tang Clan. On the dance floor, like you will recognize their funk sounds. But yeah, we're doing a documentary about them, Simond, and then there's going to be a Q&A after with the founding members and our own DJ Mona. So get your tickets on our homepage website, WFMU.org, and make sure you catch that. I'm almost out of here. I want to tell you that it's WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, 91.9 FM and online WFMU.org. This has been Radio Ravioli on every Monday, 3:01 till 6 p.m. And, oh, I won't be here next week. I'm taking the week off, but DJ Rhinestone Dinosaur is going to be filling in for me. That's happening on Monday next week. She does a great fill-in show, and I can guarantee you'll have a good time with her. So that's that, and I'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye, everybody. Stay tuned for Mark Hurst.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I will be your host for the next hour here on WFMU, Freeform Station of the Nation, live from Jersey City in the great state of New Jersey. And it is great to be here with you this evening, or whatever time of day it is when you are listening to me. And we have an excellent interview prepared. We're going to be talking about generative AI and its effects on the internet. We're going to be talking with Jason Koebler from 404 Media. This is his second time on Tectonic. I hope you have listened to Jason Koebler in the past on Tectonic, and if not, you can go in the archives at WFMU.org or Tectonic.fm to listen to that previous interview, which we'll make reference to during the interview. But this evening, Jason and I are going to talk about, as I said, generative AI and how it is affecting the internet. And it's not good. It's not a good story. Specifically, we're going to be talking about two stories that Jason wrote for 404 Media, of which he's a co-founder. Both of the stories came out on June 24. One of them is about generative AI spitting out text, and the other is generative AI spitting out, I'll say sound. I hesitate to call it music, but it's sound. So we're going to have about half of the conversation on text sludge, or I guess people are calling it slop now. And the other half is going to talk about pseudo-musical slop that is just all of this generative AI stuff is going everywhere, and it's concentrating on the platforms that monetize this stuff, like Facebook. And so we're going to talk a good bit about Facebook and where are the content moderators at Facebook. When years ago, Mark Zuckerberg said, content moderation is so important to us. We're going to be doing a better job. We're going to reinvest in content moderation. You'll see, we're going to fix this. And years later, as you will hear Jason say, Facebook seems to be doing less than ever on content moderation at the same time that generative AI slop is taking over the platform. I mean, it's two bad trends overlapping one another. And of course, it's on Facebook is where this is happening. So I'm going to play this interview, and then given some time at the end, I think we'll have a little bit of time. I have some additional comments about how else generative AI might be affecting all of us and our society. But let's start with this interview. By the way, if you want to join in the live listener chat, go to WFMU.org, click the link that says playlist and comments, and you can join the listeners who are there now. If you're listening in the future to a podcast or archived version of the show, go to tectonic.fm. That's a website address to tectonic.fm and click on the playlist link for the July 15, 2024 show. But for now, let's go ahead and listen to my interview with 404 Media's Jason Koebler here on Tectonic on WFMU. Jason Koebler, welcome back to Tectonic.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you back on the show. For listeners who don't know you, you're a co-founder of 404 Media, a site I subscribe to and like a lot, and you're a co-host of the 404 Media podcast. You were previously on Tectonic on January 8, 2024, talking about how the state of New Jersey used COVID relief funds to buy Chinese surveillance cameras to then surveil New Jersey citizens with.
Yeah, that was a fun one.
That was a fun one. If people missed that, they should go back in the archives and listen to that interview. But this time, Jason, I want to talk with you about how generative AI is causing havoc and, in some cases, outright ruining the online experience. You published two articles about this on 404 Media, both on the same day, on June 24. And I want to dive in with the first one, which is called Has Facebook Stopped Trying? And that's a headline with a question mark. Usually, Jason, when you see a headline with a question mark, the default answer is always no. But I think based on what you write in this story, it sounds like a yes, that Facebook has stopped trying.
I think the answer is yes. And to be totally honest, we don't do question mark headlines very often for the reason that you just described. We had various versions of this with expletives in the headline and sort of decided to go with something a little bit more contemplative because it actually ended up being like a pretty serious, sober-ish look at Facebook's content moderation system. And we just didn't want to turn people off with profanity in the head from the get-go. So that's why we went with this.
I appreciate it. And also that allows me to read the headline over FCC-compliant airwaves. So thank you.
Exactly.
So again, has Facebook stopped trying, from June 24 on 404 Media? In this article, you're writing about how you and another 404 Media co-founder, Joseph Cox, traveled to Facebook's headquarters several years ago. This is back in 2018. And you interviewed executives there about Mark Zuckerberg's promise at the time to improve content moderation. So this is just to say, this issue of content moderation on Facebook has been an issue for several years. Now, 6 years later, you write that, quote, Facebook has been overrun by AI-generated spam and outright scams. And you give examples of, quote, the proliferation of paid advertisements for drugs, stolen credit cards, and hacked accounts. Later, you conclude that, quote, it feels to me like Facebook has become a disastrous, zombified cesspool, which, frankly, I think would be a great tagline for the entire Meta enterprise. Jason, can you tell us what exactly is happening on Facebook right now?
Yeah, so in the aftermath of the 2016 election, which I know was now almost a decade ago, there was this reckoning for Facebook where it was sort of blamed for the Cambridge Analytica scandal, where it was sort of like building these profiles of people and delivering them fake news. And, you know, sort of like the rise of fake news was blamed on delivering Trump the presidency. And whether you believe that that had an actual impact or not, the fact is that Facebook was under a lot of fire at the time and a lot of pressure, like political pressure, commercial pressure, pressure from its users who were seeing all of these like fake stories about the Pope endorsing Trump and things like that. And in the aftermath of that, Facebook had rules and it had people who were enforcing those rules. But in the aftermath of the 2016 election, Facebook really invested a lot in content moderation and in hiring thousands and thousands of people all over the world to make sure that they were fostering healthy community is sort of what how Facebook pitched it. And around that time, we got a lot of internal documents about how Facebook enforced those rules. And that's why I ended up going to Facebook's headquarters and talking to all the people who make those rules and how they are struggling to enforce them when you have a user base of like 2 billion people all over the world. So I know that's a lot of backstory, but I came away from that experience thinking, wow, this is a very difficult problem. Facebook is trying very hard. And then for the next, 5-6 years, I did a lot of stories about illegal activity on Facebook, spam on Facebook, things like this. And Facebook would often engage with the sort of like journalistic process here and say like, oh, we're trying very hard. Here's where we think we went wrong. Here's what we're trying to do and how we're trying to fix it. And really over the last like 1 to 2 years, that back and forth has stopped entirely. But, Facebook stopping talking to me is not necessarily that big of a deal. What has happened is that when I log onto Facebook, I see tons of weird AI spam, things like Shrimp Jesus, which is this very famous, now famous picture of Jesus with shrimp arms, outright blatant fake AI images and spam and scams and hacking tools and drugs and just like very bad stuff. And this stuff is no longer reliably being removed. And in fact, it's often being promoted by its algorithms. And Facebook is like no longer talking about this. It's no longer taking this stuff down. And so that sort of led me to think, like, this content moderation team that I did this big story about, like, where are they? What happened to them? Are they, do they still exist? And I think the conclusion I've come to is that it doesn't really exist in the form that it used to. And there's a few different reasons for that. But the impact of it is basically, like, Facebook has become this cesspool. There are rules, but they are very rarely enforced. And it's a mess.
Now, you point out in the story that this idea of content moderation over the years has gotten some pushback from people on the right who say that the more content moderation a social media service has, the less that platform is really allowing free speech. But we're seeing the results of what apparently is Facebook mostly abandoning its content moderation strategy. And you write that, quote, Facebook is not a free speech heaven. It is a zombified platform full of bots, scammers, malware, bloated features, horrific AI-generated images, abandoned accounts, and dead people. It sounds like you're pointing out, I'd say persuasively, that when you remove your content moderation, it's not like this wonderful utopian free speech flowers in its absence.
Yeah, the marketplace of ideas doesn't automatically win out.
So where do you think is the dividing line between the right amount of content moderation that would actually allow some semblance of a good conversation to occur versus going too far into the realm of actual censorship, which is what people on the right are worried about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a really difficult question. And that was something I came away with the first time I talked to Facebook, is like Facebook was trying to prevent things like hate speech or overt white nationalism, among tons of other things. And in order to, like, quote unquote, enforce this, they wrote highly specific rules. Like, they tried to essentially imagine every possible human utterance and then decide, is that okay? Is this not okay? And then they are relying on this often, like, low paid workforce, not based in the United States, you know, based all around the world, to then enforce these rules when they live in a culture that has nothing to do with the place that they're doing the rules for. And then that's just in English. And Facebook is an American company that does, you know, the vast majority of its workers are English native speakers. So you then imagine that in Hindi, you imagine that in Spanish, you imagine that in Italian, you imagine that in some languages that can't even be parsed by, like, Facebook's automated systems. And you can quickly imagine how this gets to be very, very difficult. And so I think it is a very difficult question. And I think that I personally prefer to err on the side of, like, leaving a lot of things up. But I think the reason that I keep writing about this is because the types of things that I see on Facebook now are not people getting too overheated when they argue with each other and going too far, or posting, you know, a threat or something like this. Like, that does happen. But what I'm seeing is just, like, outright scams. Like, click on this link and a random file is downloaded to your computer vibes. And I guess in an extremely expansive view of what free speech is, you could say, well, people should have the free speech to hack each other and poison each other's computers and, you know, trick them into clicking on things that go to a site that has 90 pop-up ads on it and things like this. But I think that when it's been mostly Republicans, but when Republicans talk about free speech on social media, I don't think that they are usually talking about you should have the freedom to install malware on someone else's computer. That's like the bare minimum. It's like the bare minimum is they have a legal obligation to remove child sexual abuse material. And then every platform tries to prevent spam and viruses and scams and ads for meth and things like this. And Facebook is now not even deleting that stuff reliably.
And I wonder if it's this bad in the US and in English-speaking countries where, as you say, we have content moderators who are trained with English-based rules. I mean, many of the millions and millions of users around the world are using Facebook in other languages. And we've seen examples of what happens when Facebook underinvests. I mean, as poorly as they do with English content, they do even less typically in non-English content. And sadly, one of the examples that comes right to mind is the Rohingya genocide in Myanmar, which was actually predated your visit in 2018. That was late 2016 to early 2017. The Facebook algorithm was amplifying calls for violence within Myanmar, and a lot of people died as a result. And if I remember the story correctly, Facebook said, well, you know, we don't have a big content moderation team in Myanmar. And people were saying, well, you kind of have to.
I actually asked them about this while I was there. And one of the things that Facebook told me is that Burmese was not it, essentially, like, the language of Burmese and the Burmese characters could not be parsed by Facebook's automated content moderation algorithms, and they had very few people who spoke Burmese. And there was this idea at Facebook at the time, I mean, it's sort of the move fast, break things model, but they launched in this country where they had no idea what their users were saying there at all. And then when, you know, as you accurately describe, people died, and the response was just kind of like, oops, we'll try better in the future.
So if we look at today, 2024, what is the state of content moderation or the lack thereof in non-English contexts on Facebook?
I think it's very bad. I mean, it's hard to know. I think that based on my reporting, a lot of the content moderators that Facebook hired sort of in the aftermath of the Trump victory have either been kind of sidelined or laid off. There were a lot of tech layoffs during the pandemic. And I think what's surprising to me is how noticeable it is as a user. I didn't use Facebook that much. I used to use it, and then I kind of stopped using it. And I came back after a few years and I logged on, and I'm just like, this is a mess. Like, I'm just being inundated with, you know, posts from people I don't know, AI generated content, scams, etc. And like, Facebook tries the hardest in English, and so it's worse in other languages, but it's pretty bad in English now, whereas that didn't used to be the case.
I want to acknowledge that in the article you quote a past Tectonic guest, Sarah T. Roberts, who wrote a great book called Behind the Screen. Sarah is now a professor at UCLA. She said that, quote, content moderation from the perspective of the C-suite, meaning the CEOs and senior leaders of Facebook and other companies, is considered to be a cost center, and they see no financial upside in providing that service. And by the way, for listeners, that's another interview I would recommend that people listen to, because we dive into, and this is years ago, the lack of effective content moderation on Facebook and other platforms and how that really helps to juice their margins. But later in the piece, you and Sarah are discussing how, you know, one would think that good content moderation would be a good long-term strategy. The counter to that is what they have today, all these scams, malware, selling drugs and horrible stuff happening. That seems like it would turn people off. That's not a good long-term plan to keep the platform running. In your conversations with Facebook executives and others, is there any sense that Facebook understands what a poor job they're doing and how that is not a good long-term strategy?
Well, I think one of the things is that Facebook doesn't talk about this anymore. It's like, I have tried to interview Facebook executives on the record for the last year and a half as I've been doing this reporting, and they haven't talked to me even once. They've responded a few times, you know, off the record or on background, and then I'll push for them to do an interview or to talk about or show in some way that they care, and I can't get them to talk to me. And some of the stuff that I found has been very bad. Like, and by very bad, I mean illegal. Like, we're talking about, you know, I can't even say it on the radio. It's just like, it's bad, illegal content. And I'm like, here's where it is. Here's how it's happening. Here's how it's being put on your platform. Can we talk about this? And they'll take the content down that I send directly to them, but they won't talk about it. And I it's not my job to be a content moderator for Facebook, but I've now seen enough of how this is ending up on the platform that I'm like, would you like to know how they are doing it so you can tell me why your systems aren't catching it? And there's not even an interest there. I think I'm glad you brought up Sarah Roberts, though, Sarah T. Roberts, because she has a very good perspective of why content moderation exists in the first place. And her point is that advertisers don't want to be next to illegal, horrific content. And that's the fundamental reason for its existence. And I think that there, you know, this is just based on what she thinks and sort of what I believe from my reporting, that for a while, Facebook believed that it needed to do very good content moderation in order to continue selling ads. Facebook is an advertising company. Meta is an advertising company. And that may have been the case, but I think something has happened over the last, you know, 5-10 years where our attention spans are so short that any scandal passes almost immediately. And you can always point to something that is worse. And companies like to advertise. They need to advertise. They have these huge marketing budgets that they need to spend, and they have to spend them somewhere. And it's like Google and Facebook are the places that these companies spend money. And I have this idea that, you know, Elon Musk bought Twitter sort of with the stated intention of getting rid of content moderation and having it become a free speech platform. And he has gotten so much attention from the press and from the public about this. And there's been all of these sort of like scandals where Elon Musk sits on stage and says, you know, if you don't like our policies, like advertisers, go F yourself. Mark Zuckerberg doesn't need to be perfect. Facebook doesn't need to be perfect. All they need to do is not be overtly antagonistic with its advertisers, and companies will still continue to spend money on Facebook. So maybe in the long term, you know, people will move away from Facebook, like its users will move away because they don't like this sort of content. But I think that when you look at their share price, when you look at their revenue, when you look at their profits, it's all through the roof. It's like there's been no real backlash against this. And there's been a backlash against Twitter and Elon Musk, but not, like, Twitter is not dead. And when Elon Musk bought Twitter, many people said, oh, well, everyone's going to leave and people will stop advertising and it will die. And here we are, you know, a year and a half later, and it's still around. So I believe strongly that the way that Elon Musk has handled Twitter has kind of given Facebook the cover to fly under the radar a little bit.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Jason Kebler, co-founder of 404 Media, talking about the cesspool internet, I guess is a good way to describe it. The proliferation, the profusion of generative AI on services like Facebook, flooding everyone's online experience with garbage, hacks, malware, scams, illegal drug sales, and so on. And what that means for all of us in the absence of any meaningful content moderation. Speaking of Jason Kebler, he is on the comment board. If you have a question for him, you can post it right now. Go to WFMU.org and click playlists and comments. Jason, thanks for joining us. And let's go ahead and listen to the second half of my interview, where we're going to, after one more question about Facebook, we're going to go into the music side of generative AI here on Tectonic on WFMU. I want to move on to our next story after one more question on Zuck and Meta stuff. as bad as Facebook is, what I often hear people say is, oh, I don't use Facebook. It's scams. It's over. But I do use Instagram. And people will talk about how they are posting on Instagram or they're following these people on Instagram. It's such an important service. And I always think it's the same company. It's another Zuck production. Are you seeing, Jason, that Instagram is having some of the same problems as Facebook?
It has the same problems for sure. And I think we talk a lot about TikTok and how TikTok is, you know, addictive and showing propaganda to the youth and so on and so forth. I would encourage anyone who's worried about TikTok to hop on Reels on Instagram and scroll for a little while, because I see way crazier things on Instagram Reels than I do on TikTok. And for me, it's not even close. And I think one of the reasons for that is TikTok is highly content moderated. And I would argue it's too moderated. But I think that it's too moderated because TikTok doesn't want to be banned in the United States, whereas Instagram knows that it's not going to be banned in the United States. And so it's more of a free-for-all. But you're absolutely right. I mean, Instagram is a part of Facebook. Instagram is also quite bad in terms of the spam and scams and hacks. And the reason that I focus on Facebook at the moment is because it's such an old social media platform at this point. It's, you know, over 20 years old. And in that sense, I feel like its degradation is a look into the future of some of these other social media platforms. It's like, what happens when a platform is kind of abandoned? It's like, it's still got a lot of users, but the company is seemingly not investing in it anymore to the extent that it was. And I do think that the fact that it's been taken over by AI and spam and so on and so forth is kind of a look at what is going to happen to the rest of the web as they are put under the same types of pressures that Facebook has been.
And you put that idea well in the article. You write, Facebook's present, a dying, decaying colossus taken over by AI content and more or less left to rot by its owner, feels like the future or the inevitable outcome of other social platforms and of an AI-dominated internet. And I think that's a good segue to the second article that you published on 404 Media on June 24. The headline of this one is, Listen to the AI-generated ripoff songs that got Yudio and Suno sued. This story is about a lawsuit that has begun, this is you writing, the record industry has filed a list of thousands of songs it believes have been scraped without permission and has recreated versions of famous songs using Yudio and Suno. So what we have is a lawsuit from record labels, including Universal, Capitol Records, Atlantic, Warner Music, and Sony, against these two generative AI companies that generate AI music. These companies, Yudio and Suno. And what the record labels are saying is, we were able to generate songs that sound very much like songs, copyrighted songs in our possession. And because of that, it's not so much because you can generate clones of these songs, it's that what that means is that these companies used copyrighted songs to train their AI engines. And there seems to be a problem with that. So I want to start by playing an example so listeners can hear. We're going to listen to a little bit of an AI-generated song called All I Want for Christmas Is You. Now, what we're going to hear is not Mariah Carey singing. This is all AI-generated, and it was generated with a prompt that included her name and words like contemporary R&B, holiday, vocal range, and so on. Let's listen to a bit of it. Okay, so again, that was an AI-generated version of All I Want for Christmas Is You. The record labels are alleging that Udio and Suno apparently used the original Mariah Carey song, or the original of whatever band's songs, in the training of their AI engine. Did I get that right?
Yeah, you did get it right. I think it's a pretty interesting lawsuit for that reason, because the record industry is not exactly alleging that the song that you just heard is copyright infringement, although they say that they like retain the right to argue that it is copyright infringement. But what the record industry is arguing, as you mentioned, is that the entire foundation of these services is based on training their algorithms with copyrighted music. And so the fact that they were able to essentially reproduce All I Want for Christmas Is You, or various Green Day songs, these various Chuck Berry songs, there's like a few hundred in the lawsuit, suggests that this music was scraped without compensating these record labels and without consent of these record labels, which I think makes it a pretty interesting lawsuit, because it's not as straightforward as saying we were able to make a clone or a cover, an AI cover of All I Want for Christmas Is You. They're arguing that the entire business model of these companies is essentially fraudulent.
I also appreciated in your 404 Media article that you posted or embedded some of the documents from the lawsuit. Listeners, you can go and you can scroll through and you can see all of the individual songs that are being cited. This list includes tons of songs from Ray Charles, Otis Redding, Michael Jackson, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, and some more recent bands as well. And so, Jason, I wanted to ask for the several hundred songs from just those bands. Since they're listed individually, each song, in the documentation, does that mean that the record labels submitted an example AI-generated song for each one of those original songs?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Like, as a reporter, when I was reading this, they essentially had links to the clones of these songs, of like hundreds of songs, and you can go and listen to them, and they're still online. I think at this point, they probably cannot delete them, but my favorite one is Time of Your Life by Green Day, or that's what it was called. The actual song is called Good Riddance, and the prompt was, quote, a reproduction of a nostalgic acoustic ballad by a pop punk band famous in the 1990s, whose name rhymes with Mean May, and whose lead singer has a name that rhymes with Millie Mo Marmstrong. and just sort of as like an investigative technique, this is quite interesting, because I just like to imagine, you know, a paralegal or a researcher for the RIAA, which is the record industry, typing in all of these, you know, trying to essentially trick these AI systems into reproducing copyrighted work. It's actually something that we do a lot as reporters when we're trying to see if a new AI tool is easy to break, for lack of a better term. They sort of did the same thing.
Okay, so I thought it was really helpful to read about this case in 404 Media. I didn't hear about this anywhere else. What it points to for me is that there's corporate money from various media industries pushing back on Silicon Valley AI money and saying, hey, stop scraping our stuff, stop stealing our stuff. One of the high profile cases that comes to mind is that the New York Times is suing OpenAI for apparently doing the same thing, training ChatGPT on copyrighted New York Times articles. The Times shared some examples of typing whatever as a prompt to the ChatGPT, and what comes out is word for word almost the entire body of a copyrighted New York Times article.
The thing that is so interesting about this specific case is the RIAA is infamous for suing people. It's the people who send you a nasty letter if you pirate music. They're famous for sort of the Napster cases and things like this. And for that reason, a lot of average people hate the RIAA. They're seen as this big evil bully, but they're very good at winning lawsuits. That's kind of their whole thing. Thus far, the AI lawsuits have been coalitions of authors, coalitions of artists, like small groups of artists who, you know, allege that their work has been trained by things like OpenAI or Midjourney. And then, of course, the New York Times case. And the New York Times is a huge company, but it pales in comparison to the entirety of the record label industry. You know, we're talking Sony, Universal, Warner, like all of these massive companies. And, you know, Udio and Suno are startups, but they're startups that are funded by major venture capital firms. And so you sort of have this now Goliath versus Goliath lawsuit. And I do think that, you know, anyone who is an artist, a writer, a musician, is very interested in how this is all going to shake out. Because, you know, I'm a writer, our stuff has been scraped and reproduced by AI and used to profit by other people. And I don't love that. I think that a lot of artists think that they're being automated out of a job by algorithms and large language models and generative AI systems that have been trained on their work and they haven't been compensated for it. And so I think that this lawsuit is actually quite important. I don't know how it's going to shake out, but I think that the fact that it is trying to answer the question of whether training an AI on work without permission is legal is a very important question for the future of AI, but also for the future of like human labor.
And for anyone who's a creator of some sort, a musician, a writer, and so on, am I right in thinking that in this one instance, we should actually be rooting for the record labels and the major media company against the AI companies?
Well, that was a lot of the response to my article, was a lot of people, a lot of like musicians and artists saying, I never thought I would be cheering on the RIAA, but here I am cheering on the RIAA. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess I worry about what I wish for, because I do think that there needs to be some sort of compensation model or permission structure for training these types of tools. But I also don't know what is going to come out on the other side of something like this. You know, it might be as simple as they come to some sort of settlement and Udio and Suno have to pay royalties or something like that. But I think that the outcome is very important, whether it will be a good one for working journalists, working writers, working artists, musicians, I have no idea.
It just brings me back to our previous point in the conversation where we're talking about Sarah T. Roberts showing that really the incentives of these large companies is to cater to their larger advertisers. Basically, corporate money wants to take care of other corporate money. This has come up before on the show. I remember years ago, someone, one of my guests, was telling me a story about how an independent filmmaker found that her film that she had used her life savings and several years of her life to create had been uploaded onto YouTube, and other people were monetizing her work. And so she contacted Google's YouTube and said, please take down all of these other instances of my film, these illegal uploads of my film. And they wouldn't do it. Oh, you have to fill out this form, you have to wait, we're busy, whatever. But God forbid somebody say one thing about Mickey Mouse on a social media service. 5 seconds later, there's a takedown notice from Disney, or it's down automatically by the corporate-friendly content moderators. And here again with this AI-generated music, you know, what gets these AI companies' attention is major corporate money pushing back on them saying, hey, don't scrape my stuff. It's like watching Godzilla fight Gamera or something, and we're just the little people trying to avoid getting stomped by their feet. It's hard to really root for either one of those monsters. What I'd like to see is some context where independent creators, artists, writers, and small groups are actually being valued for their work, rather than everything being tied to the desires of major corporate capital.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And a parallel there is this text file called robots.txt, and it's a thing that you can upload to your website. And it basically, you're allowed to say, if you are a website owner, don't scrape or index my website. The foundation of a lot of these AI tools is the mass scraping of human output wherever it is. And it's very hard to know whether your website has been scraped or has been not scraped. And there's been sort of this sort of like ongoing controversy where, like, as a creator or a small website owner, you have to proactively opt out of having your stuff taken by Lord knows which AI tool. And it might be the case that you say, I don't want OpenAI to scrape my website. And OpenAI might respect that, but some upstart other large language model might not. And who has the time to think of all of the potential people who are going to steal your content and proactively opt out of it? That's not even to mention that a lot of these AI tools ignore what people want, because it's hard to know whether any individual piece of content is in these massive data sets. And so it's just very hard to maintain ownership over your work and to push back against it and to be compensated for it. I think that what we're seeing with this RIAA lawsuit is that it's not that the record labels don't want AI generated music to exist. It's that they want to be compensated for it, or they want to be a part of it. I think it was very interesting when Spotify's CEO, Daniel Ek, said that the cost of creating content is, quote, close to zero. You know, he's kind of walked that back since. But I think that the thought here is, well, if we don't have to pay these artists to make music, we can just have AI generate it for us. And I think that that is a future that is probably not one that the record labels are scared of. They probably want to generate, infinite music as long as they're getting a piece of that pie.
I'm not sure that really serves the long-term interests of people who love music. But we'll have to pick that up on the next conversation when we cover your next deep dive into some horrific emerging dystopia online, which I always appreciate you keeping me informed about what's happening in all seriousness on 404 Media. Tell us a little bit about your 404 Media podcast and where we can get that, Jason.
Yeah, so we are an independent journalist-owned website and podcast. I know I talked a lot on this episode, but if you want to hear more from me, we publish every week about topics like this, and you can find us anywhere you get podcasts. We're called the 404 Media Podcast. It's a very inventive name.
Jason Kebler, thanks again for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I will remain your host for the next 14 minutes, if all goes to plan. And then the man you can't handle, Dave Mandel, comes on with his prog rock show called It's Complicated. Just how complicated it is, you're going to have to take a listen and see for yourself. And then Bad Animals with Jim the Poet, who's on the comment board. Hi, Jim and Amanda. And then Brother Daniel Blumen with his eponymous show starting at 9 p.m. Eastern, taking us to midnight. Please stay tuned for those excellent shows. I also want to say thanks to Jason Kebler, co-founder of 404 Media, for being with us yet again. Always a pleasure to have Jason on the show and on the comment board this evening. You have a few more minutes. If you have a burning question for Jason, you can post it if you go to WFMU.org and click playlist and comments. I've also put a link on the playlist to Jason's podcast. As he said, the very creatively named The 404 Media Podcast, which I'd recommend. The link is right there. And you can also see Jason's very first appearance on Tectonic just 6 months ago, thereabouts, from January 8, 2024, when we're talking about the surveillance cameras bought with COVID funds in order to spy on New Jersey citizens. That was an interesting episode. But I also appreciate Jason writing these two articles on June 24 on 404 Media called Has Facebook Stopped Trying? And Listen to the AI-generated ripoff songs that got Udio and Suno sued. And you can see links to both of those on the playlist. Plenty for you to follow up on the playlist to read and or listen to. And as I said earlier, if you're listening to a podcast or archive version, go to tectonic.fm, that's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and click on the July 15, 2024 playlist, and it's all there. You can also see the comments everybody had this evening, and I hope you found that helpful. Speaking of dates and schedules and so on, I wanted to let you know before I forget, I am going to be out next week. I'm not going to be here for next week's show, but the great Brian Dunleavy is going to be filling in. He is the host of Currents here on WFMU. It's a show on Saturday mornings from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. He does this very clever format of a show where he intersperses current news clips with music that he has chosen to speak to the news, and the news speaks to the music. It's an interesting combination, which you should take a listen to. But Brian's going to be here in Studio A in the Tectonic Captain's Chair next Monday, and I know you will have a good time listening to him, as I will as well. I'll be out of town, but I plan to be back in 2 weeks. And let me tell you now what my plan is for the show in 2 weeks. In case you have any questions or comments that you want to email to me at mark@wfmu.org, I'm planning on doing a show on the so-called sandwich generation. And those of you of a certain age know exactly what I'm talking about. But if you don't know that phrase, a sandwich generation is people who are at an age where they have aging parents that they are they're keeping in mind as or possibly helping to take care of, and they have kids that they are also trying to raise. And so I'd say early middle-aged generation is concerned both with the older and the younger generation. They're in the middle, so they are the sandwich generation. And I want to do a sandwich generation episode because in my reading, I'm getting a lot of news and commentary and ideas that I want to share with you on both of those sides. On the elder side, there's a lot that I want to tell you about what people are saying about how to deal with your parents or your in-laws or other aging relatives or even friends with their digital assets as they're getting a little bit older. And then on the kids' side, what do we do with this next generation that seems to be glued to their surveillance phones? What are we to do? What are some tips and thinking? And there's some good writing out there with some tips and some ideas that I'll share with you. So again, an episode on the sandwich generation in 2 weeks. That's going to be on July 29. If you have comments or questions, you can email them to mark@wfmu.org. That's mark@wfmu.org, and I'll see if I can work some of that in. In the last few minutes of tonight's show, I just wanted to say something about, I guess you could say, the elephant in the living room, which I haven't mentioned at all. We here in the U.S. a few days ago saw some shocking and horrific political violence, which I am totally opposed to. This happened at a presidential campaign rally in Pennsylvania. And I'm not going to get into the politics, and I'm not going to surmise what the attackers' motivations were and the relevance for the presidential campaign. For Pete's sake, I'm not a political analyst or expert. But I do know something about technology, and technology indirectly, hear me now, indirectly played a role in creating the environment that we live in from which political violence is bound to spring up. Now, I'm not blaming any tech company or tech billionaire for what happened a few days ago, okay? I want to be clear on that. But I do want to say something that political violence is a symptom of a sick society. And if you want an analysis of this particular incident, I would point you to the column by Timothy Snyder. You can look it up online. I thought he had some good thoughts. But just in terms of the general landscape, political violence comes out of an environment of sickness, of social disease. And let me list some of the factors that might have played a role in this particular incident and may have contributed to other politically violent incidents we've seen in recent years. Number one, increased loneliness and social isolation. Number two, worse mental health. And number three, more widening political division. Can you think of a force in society right now that has been documented again and again as having those outcomes on society? Increased social isolation, worse mental health, and widening political divisions. Well, that would be social media. That would be big tech and social media services, specifically services like Facebook that we were just talking about with Jason Kubler. Again, I'm not saying that there's a direct line from Facebook to what happened a few days ago, but I am saying that the effects that services like Facebook have repeatedly been documented as having and forcing onto society are the same kinds of diseases that create an environment where violence springs up, political violence springs up. And who knows which of these might have played a role in Friday's incident. Again, I'm not pointing to exact causes for Friday's incident, but I'm just talking about the environment that we live in is heavily influenced by the decisions that the leaders of those companies make and how those algorithms work, how the business model manipulates people, okay? And how could those decisions of big tech leaders not affect society? When you have billions of people logging into these sludge factories every day, how could they not have an effect widely on society? And what we're learning and what we just learned from Jason Kubler is what gets served up increasingly on services like Facebook is sludge, AI slop. It's garbage. Let's just call it. It's garbage. Garbage being delivered to billions of people a day. Meanwhile, local newspapers are dying out. Journalism is the ranks of journalists are being thinned. Public libraries are struggling for funding. Education is increasingly being infiltrated by these same companies that are selling their own garbage products into the schools. And meanwhile, social media gets more and more and more powerful and influential. What do we think is going to happen when those are the factors at play? So what are we supposed to do? And I thought listener Gabriel on the comment board had a very pithy comment. Gabriel writes, "The internet used to be fun. Now it sucks. Go for a walk. Hang out with your friends and neighbors. Play Mahjong." I would say yes to all those. Throw your phone in the river, metaphorically. Spend some time away from screens with people you love and respect. And for God's sake, go to the public library and get a book, a print book that will not surveil you. And keep listening, whatever you do, to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Until I see you in a couple of weeks, friends, you know what to do. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And I thought we could finish with a couple of, actually three quick examples of AI-generated ripoffs that were included in Jason Kubler's 404 Media article. We're going to hear AI ripoffs of the Beach Boys, then ABBA, and then Carl Perkins. And just think on this, friends. This could be our future if we don't do something. Have a great week. The way the sunlight plays upon her hair, I hear the sound of a gentle word on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air. I'm picking up good vibrations, she's giving me the excitation. I'm picking up good vibrations, she's giving me the excitation. Round, round, get around, I get around. Could be that guy. Night is young and the music's high with a bit of rock music. Everything is fine. You're in the mood for a dance and when you get the chance. Yeah, down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans. Way back up in the woods among the evergreen. They set a old cabin made of earth and wood. Where lived a country boy named Johnny B. Good. Who never ever learned to read or write so well. Play a guitar just like a ringing a bell. Go, go! Go, Johnny, go! Go! Go, Johnny, go! Go! Go, Johnny, go! Go! Go, Johnny, go! Go! Johnny, be good. Oh, get down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans. Way back up in the woods among the evergreen. There stood a old cabin made of earthen wood. Where lived a country boy named Johnny B. Good. Who never ever learned to read or write so well. But he could play guitar just like a ringing a bell. Go, go!
That syncopated sound tells you it's time for this week's installment of It's Complicated. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here every Monday at this time, which is 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and we bring you an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music, P-R-O-G. I met someone at a party one time, and I told her that I play prog rock on my show, and she thought, P-R-A-G-U-E, and she tuned in expecting to hear music from the Czech Republic. I sometimes play music from the Czech Republic, but it's not that at all, no. Prog rock. Welcome, great to be here, always thrilled. I am thrilled always to play music for you, and thanks for tuning in. We're going to start tonight's show. You know, occasionally I'll also put in a little plug here, which I think I've done before. The WFMU playlist search function. Go to the WFMU webpage, and it will guide you there. There's a function, a page, a link that will allow you to search the complete archives of this radio station. It's amazing, and see, you know, who has played this band or that band or this song or this album. And I use that sometimes just to keep myself honest. You know, have I not played these people yet or those people yet? And to my surprise, I checked recently for Universe Zero, who were a crucial prog or a symphonic, let's call them a symphonic rock group, definitely a prog group. And to my surprise, man, I've been doing a show here for at FMU for a long time. This show, It's Complicated, has only been here for a couple years, less than a couple years. And to my surprise, I was actually kind of excited, kind of happy. I actually have never played Universe Zero on this show yet. So we're going to fix that now. Universe Zero were from Belgium, from Brussels, Belgium. And as I said, one of the great symphonic prog bands. They played, I guess their influences were early 20th century, Stravinsky and that kind of thing, you know. Art Zoid would be, I guess, spiritual siblings of Universe Zero. So we're going to hear Universe Zero doing a piece called Combat, about 13 minutes or so. Relax, you will like this.